It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your host from SteelersDepot.com, where you can find all your latest and greatest Steelers news. It's Dave Bryan and Alex Cazzora, always Lynn, talking Steelers. And now, here's Dave and Alex.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast, Season 14, Episode 111. He's Dave Bryan. I'm Alex Cazzora, SteelersDepot.com. Thanks for being back with us here this Friday, Steelers Nation. Happy opening day to the Pittsburgh Pirates, to all those attending. Going to be a little chilly tonight, but the Pirates' hot streak, 6-1 to start the year, will warm us up, as will the new addition. Dave, to quote the Hangover, our Wolfpack has grown by one. Tight end Michael Pruitt is now a Pittsburgh Steeler. So some news here on this Friday. How you doing, Dave?
Happy Friday. I'm doing well. It's chilly here in Vegas this morning. I stepped outside to potty the dog, and it's chilly.
It warm up by noon?
It should, but I mean, normally we're this part of the calendar here, it's not usually that chilly. It was pretty shocking when you step outside this morning there, but it'll warm up there, and we'll start warming up here with we got some a little bit of news, kind of in addition to sort of the, I don't know, what would you call it, the media kind of lineup. Kind of we put out videos and podcasts or whatnot. So why don't we start by kind of introducing kind of one of the new shows, if you will, to the Steelers Depot family.
Absolutely. It's a new show to the Steelers Depot lineup, the show from Ross McCorkle and Joe Clark. We are super excited about overall. Their first episode went up on YouTube and up on the site yesterday. It's going to air on Thursdays here, and so we're really excited about that. The show is the Depot Dive, episode one, going up. It's hosted by Ross and Joe, who have been great members of the site now for Joe for a couple of years. Ross really kind of joined full steam this past year. So the Depot Dive will go up probably into our podcast feed here next couple of days. Get that in the rotation. Episode one was fantastic. They went over the offseason, draft plans, kind of discussing, debating. So really excited for those guys to start their own show. The response has been fantastic just across the board. I think everyone's been really impressed by the quality of the production, the conversation, et cetera. So the Depot Dive, the newest show to the Steelers Depot lineup.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought they did. Boy, I'm thinking back to show number one of the Terrible Podcast. And
we got to find that.
Let's not. but yeah, I thought they planned it out real well. And I think it'll only get better moving forward there. That was the first stab at it. And a lot of planning went into it. And I obviously just recently, since back in February there, I went to go visit Ross in Nashville and Joe up in Boston and spend time with both of those guys. We've obviously invested a lot in those two. Joe, as you mentioned, well, really both of them have been with the site a long time. Ross just mm-hmm. wasn't full time. Ross was doing things like created the Depot 180 that runs, how many times a week does that run? Once, twice a week.
Yep.
Yeah, twice a week. So he had a hand in creating that. That's become a staple. And, both of them obviously have sat in on episodes of the Terrible Podcast, especially around draft time and things of that nature. So it's an interesting format that they have going. I think they're going to try to shorten that thing down to about 30 minutes per episode in total and try to hit three topics three key talking points every week and all. And they've got a phone number people can call and ask questions on and that sort of thing there. So kudos to them. And if you haven't checked it out yet, you can, the as Alex mentioned, the inaugural episode is up on YouTube on the Depot YouTube channel. And I will be turning that into podcast form later today. So if you only listen to our work via the podcast feed, that'll pop up in there later on today for everybody that is subscribed to that. So with that, I think you broke some other news there ahead of things. Mykole Pruitt, the Pittsburgh Falcons grew by one.
Yes, Arthur Smith signing the third former Falcon, joining Cordarrelle Patterson and Van Jefferson. So Mykole Pruitt, the tight end who has been with Smith for almost, you know, the back half of his career, was initially a fifth round pick out of Minnesota from Southern Illinois, but was with Smith in Tennessee in 2018 when Smith was the tight ends coach, and then was with him, of course, in 2019, 2020 when Smith was the OC in Tennessee, and then Pruitt signed with Atlanta in 2022 and spent the past 2 years there where, of course, Smith was the head coach, and now in Pittsburgh where Smith is the OC. So those two know each other extremely well. 32 years old, has been lightly used in the passing game the past two seasons, 25 receptions, although he does have 5 touchdowns, all in the red zone. I think 3 of them have come within the 5-yard line, including a touchdown in 2022 against the Pittsburgh Steelers from 7 yards out in that win that Pittsburgh had over Atlanta. So he's really an inline blocker. Have a film study up on him this morning. It's kind of a what you see is what you get kind of a deal, but we know Arthur Smith, he loves his tight ends, and so this tight end room is filling up pretty quickly in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, you get a guy that's on the other side of 30 here, has obviously, as you stated, been around a little bit, you know, around the league, and obviously spent time with Arthur Smith in both Tennessee and Atlanta, as you mentioned there. Kind of the original kind of just a little bit longer version of Connor Hayward, right? You know, I mean, because he's not a huge guy overall. What was he, 6'2", something like that, 245? A little bit thicker, I guess, maybe overall than compared to Connor Hayward there. Here's the long and short on this. You can never, you know, we always talk about veteran guys, adding veteran guys to this roster, especially on veteran benefit contracts. It's hard to imagine. Of course, I said the same thing about Lowry. That ended up being more than a veteran benefit deal. But this is, at least early reports say that this is a one-year deal for him. And you would think that would be a veteran benefit contract. I think if you look back at the contract he signed with Atlanta last year, I think that was a veteran benefit contract and only included a $50,000 signing bonus. So it'd be interesting to see if he got a $167,500 signing bonus with him. As you stated, you know, primarily used as a blocker there. I rolled through some quick segments of his all 22 tape, Alex. And then, I know you've got a film room up on him on this site this morning. You seem to be a little bit more impressed with his blocking than I am. I thought it was wildly inconsistent and jumping around. There were good aspects of it, but for every high, there seemed to be a low. I think he was a better blocker from what I remember, you know, a couple years ago. But I mean, if we're talking about 2023 tape specifically, I just kind of viewed it as a little bit probably more inconsistent than you did. Now, he does have some special teams ability, but I think most of it, at least last year, was predicated to him being on the kickoff return team there. So obviously, you know, utilizing this blocking aspect as part of that. And, you know, we've already talked about the changes to the kickoff rule. Going to be interesting to see how that plays out. I view it as a plus that you get a guy that comes in that probably knows what to expect out of Arthur Smith and kind of the core aspects of the offense. And that will obviously, I think, help with installation and, you know, relaying the language and you know, all that kind of stuff that comes with that. So I think you get a plus in that overall there. I just think based on where he's at in his career, what I've seen, just turning 32 years old at the end of last month as well, too. I don't think you need to write him down in pen when it comes to the 53-man roster.
Sure, especially assuming it's a one-year deal for that veteran minimum benefit, and given how crowded the tight end room is, you would be a step too far to call Pruitt a lock to make this roster. Yeah, I thought his blocking, even in 23, maybe we just watched different tape, and yeah, it wasn't amazing. I just felt serviceable and high energy and doing the job well enough was my kind of take on his blocking. Not that it was overwhelmingly good or as, you know, high as where Donald Washington can get, where he's truly washing players and pancaking players at his best, but it just seemed to be solid and serviceable and did the job and did it well enough overall, even doing stuff in pass protection, which, you know, you don't see a lot of tight ends do, but that was kind of his role, was inline blocker, true Y type. Pruitt, I thought, did that job just fine last year. He did mostly blocking. He played 402 offensive snaps and caught only nine passes the entire season. So, I mean, he was truly there to block most of the time, even again in some pass protection. You know, when he did catch the ball, it was really play pass crossers and stuff in the flat off of boot action and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, 32, you know, what I think he goes back to, and it's probably no coincidence that you have now signed a former Falcon for each of your skill positions for that room, for receiver in Jefferson, for running back in Patterson, and tight end in Pruitt. So we talked about with the Patterson signing, you know, veterans that know the Smith offense and can kind of teach it to some of the returning, you know, skill guys in each of those position groups. And so I think it's actually probably value in nominally, at least, not that it's huge, but, you know, some value in having veterans that can talk to, you know, the returning players, you know, Najee and Pickens and Freiermuth and Washington, and say that this is kind of how the offense works and be almost kind of student teachers in a sense for these returning players.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there is benefit to that. And it's good for you to point out that it has happened at wide receiver, running back, and tight end. So he's really got, you know, Arthur Smith really kind of stamping this up to some degree. And look, a lot of the jokes for the next 24 hours will indeed be the Pittsburgh Falcons or Atlanta North, Atlanta Northeast. I get all that kind of stuff, but it's not uncommon when you have an outside, offensive coordinator, really any kind of coordinator, to come in that, you know, especially if he's been around for a little bit, for a couple of players that have played for him previously, to follow him. So, you know, I don't think that's unusual in that aspect of it overall there. Boy, him laying out for that ball again, that game for that touchdown against the Jets was impressive last year. Once again, doesn't have a lot of catches, but and I think, as you mentioned, you know, scores come deep low in the red zone there. He's got an innate ability, it looks like, to kind of get lost in the traffic sometimes and find himself leaking out.
Yeah, you know? Why leak is his play.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. You know, if he makes the roster, ultimately, you could foresee him getting a touchdown or two in the red zone via something along those lines there. So, and then once again, it's not like he's entirely worthless when it comes to special teams. I would expect that if he did make the team, it would probably be mainly on the kickoff return team, you know, along those lines there too. I think the question here, and look, once again, I don't think he's guaranteed to make the 53-man roster, but I'm more apt to think that a guy like Connor Hayward will, because he does have special teams value and he does have great hands and you can move him around a little bit. Probably not the blocker by no means. And by me saying Michael Pruitt, you know, was inconsistent in my view in 2023 blocking tape, while I think Connor Hayward's blocking did improve in 2023, I don't think he's where Pruitt's at. Would you agree?
Sure. I mean, Pruitt is bigger. I mean, you know, Connor Hayward's 5'11 and Pruitt's 6'2. Pruitt has good length. He's got 33.5-inch arms, which is, you know, really good length overall, especially given for kind of a shorter, you know, stockier build. And he just works better in line. I mean, Hayward, you know, what he can do is the Y off type of stuff where he can split zone. And we talked about him on cut blocks last year being effective. Blocking out in space. Pruitt's really an inline kind of guy that can base up on defensive ends and climb to linebackers, and that's kind of more his scene. So they're kind of different blockers and different usages. Hayward can't be used as consistently in the way that Pruitt has been used in Smith's offenses in past years.
Let's assume, and that's dangerous to do on April the 5th. Let's assume you have in the backfield Najee, Jalen Warren, Cordarrelle Patterson as your depth chart there. And as far as however you want to group them, tight end, H-back, fullback of Freiermuth, Washington, Hayward, and Pruitt. That's a lot of bodies there.
And Rodney Williams. Can't forget about your man, Hot Rod.
And look, you love
Rodney Williams.
I think for one thing, the special teams value. Danny Smith's going to be pounding the table for that. for that
save his life. Yeah, you don't forget those things.
Yeah, and look, I think on top of it too, I thought Hot Rod did some nice things in the blocking aspect, a lot more than what I expected. You know, I thought he improved. Now, look, he's a different kind of build, different kind of player. But I think for what he has been in the past and what he was asked to do last season in his limited playing time, especially in the blocking department, I thought he represented himself well overall. So let's put it to you this way. Let's say one of Pruitt or Rodney. I mean, for all those guys, I mean, you just added Rodney Williams to that list. I mean, that's a lot of bodies on a 53 for two position groups, right?
Sure. It's five tight ends with Sunday experience. We'll talk about this probably more in a second, but this is kind of becoming the Arthur Smith offense in his vision. It is a bunch of tight ends. It's not a ton of receiver focus. It's heavy personnel. And so it gets really heavy at positions like tight ends. So I think whatever question you were going at, but they're probably going to keep four tight ends this year.
All right. Well, here's where I was going as the back end of that. I mean, you're barring injury, you're going to have Najee, Warren, Patterson on the roster. Mm-hmm. You're more than likely going to have Freiermuth, Washington, Hayward, and potentially let's say one of Pruitt or Williams.
Yep.
How many wide receivers are you carrying? You're going to have, here's the other thing aspect. This team going to carry three quarterbacks. They always do, except for really one season. But with this new quarterback rule of the promotion of you can promote a quarterback from the practice squad unlimited amount of times to be the number three, did that just open up a roster spot for a team that normally carries three quarterbacks for the Steelers?
I know we had that discussion, but that was pre-Kyle Allen signing.
Yes.
And if they sign Allen, you know, even though it is the veteran benefit contract, they're signing him for a reason. And somebody I had read a good counterpoint to, yes, you can now freely elevate that quarterback each week, but that does take up one of your two standard elevations. So if you ever had multiple injuries, you'd only have one free spot for a standard elevation of another player in kind of your weekly roster churn injury protection. So there actually still is an incentive to carry that third quarterback, because if you did the practice squad yo-yo for the elevation standpoint, that'd be taking up half of your, you know, spots to elevate guys, you know, on Saturdays.
All right. So an elevation.
So yes, of I think three quarterbacks. Sorry.
So, all right. So an elevation of a quarterback does count as one of your two then.
My understanding is yes. I'll have to maybe double check the rule, but I was reading some commentary on that, and I believe it still would count as one of your two allowable elevations.
Okay. You know, circling back to the original conversation there, you know, I guess where I'm going here is what is the it seems to be pointing toward this team maybe only carrying four wide receivers, right?
You'd have to do the math. I mean, I think
because technically Patterson, right? It won't be six, but and you know, Patterson has obviously played some wide receiver in the NFL, so that could kind of get at least a guy that could be serviceable if you ran into a pinch in that situation. So, you know, he'll technically be listed as a running back slash wide receiver. I mean, a kick returner.
Let me just kind of walk through it.
This is way too early for us to have this, but this is what we do.
What you expect from us. So you keep three quarterbacks, just mapping out one scenario, three quarterbacks, three running backs, four tight ends, five receivers. That gets you 6'10", 15 players so far. You need to carry, I mean, typically they carry 9 offensive linemen. Is that a fair number? You need to dress.
Wait a minute. They've been dressing 7 with 2 inactive. Right. Okay. 9.
Okay. So even if you do that, that's 24 offensive players, correct? You got 3 quarterbacks, 3 running backs, 4 tight ends, 5 receivers, 9 offensive linemen, 24. I mean, you know, that typically your rosters either go 24 on offense, you know, between 24 and 26 is typically how offense defensive sides work. So, I mean, I think that's, you know, very much realistic. You can still do that without having to shortchange a quarterback.
Okay. So, but that's with just 4 wide receivers, right?
No, that's with 5 receivers. Okay, that's 3 quarterbacks, 5. 3 running backs, 4 tight ends, 5 running backs, or 5 wide receivers, excuse me, and 9 offensive linemen.
Okay. All right. That math works. All right.
And then you can still do an extra offensive player, or you can go 26 on defense. So, I mean, again, you shake things out. And again, as you said, you know, far too early, but I think they're going to keep 4 tight ends. I think they're going to not keep 6 receivers is kind of where I'm sitting at today.
Right. Okay. All right. That adds up.
And then Pruden, the passing game, I don't know if you had any thoughts on that. You know, physical, red zone, made some plays. But, you know, he really is, you know, regardless of how you evaluate the blocking, he is, his purpose has become to become a blocker.
Yeah, I just wonder how you, you know, who comes off the field if he's on the field.
Yeah, just part of different packages. I mean, it will be, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but he'll be out there in heavier personnel, in 12 personnel, 13. Could he even play some fullback? I was looking at the PFF just alignments, and they counted him for 40 backfield snaps. I didn't see him line up as a fullback or really even anything other than true inline Y in any of the 4 games that I watched of his. But, you know, it's the potential that we know Smith's offenses typically do have a fullback. You know, could Connor Hayward get some looks there? I know people always love mentioning Jack Coletto, and he'll get a chance in camp as well. You know, Pruitt, I don't know how much he's done it, but I feel like somebody's going to get a look at fullback.
Yeah, it does, Phil. It'll be one of the things that should stick out for you like a sore thumb when you get to camp and all like that, I'm sure. So, yeah, we'll definitely be watching that transpire once we get into camp.
Did Pittsburgh, someone announced some visits? Let me double check here. I thought I might have just saw. No, I think that was something else. But yeah, so that's the news on Pruitt. And just a quick sidebar, kind of the weird weather. Apparently a 4.8 earthquake in New York today. Huh. Just seeing our group chat, one of our guys, Joe C, just felt it. So it's some crazy weather going on. Hopefully everyone in New York is okay.
Absolutely. That's weird.
All right. Any final thoughts here on Pruitt? Again, 1-year deal, low level signing, Arthur Smith getting his guys. And so that seems to be the trend this offseason has been going.
Yeah, absolutely. It has been. You would think that probably he was just waiting to see what else was out there. They probably had the offer on the table for him for a little while, but he probably wanted to wait to see how things transpired. Talking about Pruitt through the first couple of weeks here, and probably found that, why not go somewhere where you have some familiarity with the OC there? Probably wasn't going to get much more than a veteran benefit contract elsewhere. So that's probably why he had not signed earlier.
Right. Makes sense. All right, Dave, some other news here. Pittsburgh announcing they have waived yesterday running back Alphonso Graham. And no disrespect to Alphonso Graham, but I'm sure some people didn't know that Alphonso Graham was a Steeler until they announced that he was waived. He was a rookie tryout guy from Morgan State last year, got hurt early in training camp. Still remember that play, tore his labrum in his shoulder. It was a 7-on-7 drill. They weren't even in pads, I don't think. And he, you know, fell, wasn't even touched, and just slipped and fell and landed hard on his right shoulder. And you know, his season was essentially done, carried on IR. So that's the move there. Alphonso Graham officially waived by the team.
Yeah, and I think people want to know why wait until right now. Well, it could be he had surgery after that and obviously had to recover from that. So this may have been a situation you just had to wait until he got fully recovered. You know, and look, there's no rush at this point in the offseason. Heck, they've still got several roster spots they can fill to get up to 90. And this is just, you know, procedural probably as far as the time that he spent on the roster overall. And, you know, he had really no prayer at making the 53 for the most part. And so that, you know, just part ways with him now. So with him out, he did not impact the rule of 51 because he was outside of it already on a minimum salary. And so basically with him out and Pruitt in, your roster remains at 74 under contract right now.
There you go. Heading into the draft, where Pittsburgh currently has 7 picks. Oh, we'll talk about draft here in just one moment. One other piece of Steelers free agency news. They had a visit with Kalik Hudson, the former Commanders linebacker, earlier this week. But Hudson will not become a Steeler. He has signed a 1-year deal with the New Orleans Saints. And so we'll see if Pittsburgh looks for any other veteran free agent linebackers. But it will not be Kalik Hudson, who has now signed with New Orleans.
Right. So it's interesting. I can't wait to see what that deal is. You would think probably a veteran benefit deal, but stranger things have happened.
Yeah, it was 1 year. We know that. Don't know the financial numbers to it. You just wonder if that was a better opportunity he felt like he had in New Orleans, given that, you know, you see Patrick Queen get signed and you do have Roberts and Holcomb potentially. And Hudson may think, well, I played some on defense last year. I don't want to go back to be pure backup, pure special teamer. I don't know if the Saints had a free agent linebacker. Oh, who was it that they had this year? Zach Bond. I don't know where he went. I don't know if he went back to New Orleans or not. So a better opportunity, I assume, is why Hudson passed up Pittsburgh for the Saints.
All right.
Pittsburgh having 3 pre-draft visitors on Thursday. We'll see if any more come out on Friday. I think maybe we'll get some more today, but we'll have to wait and see. But 3 new names, which is good to add to our list and our pre-draft visit tracker. They are Clemson corner Nate Wiggins, viewed as a likely first-round pick. Rice receiver Luke McCaffrey, the younger brother of Christian McCaffrey, and Oregon offensive lineman, really a guard, Stephen Jones. He's projected to be a late-round pick, potential undrafted free agent. So Wiggins, Dave, the headline name, a lot of Blues clues you could connect to Nate Wiggins.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And a guy that we've run down already as part of the short list, if you will, of those guys that check a lot of the boxes when it comes to the Blues clues. Obviously, Tomlin and Khan at that pro day. Power 5, RAS guy. What else with him? I mean, just been in for a visit now. Oh, a lot of boxes checked when it comes to him. You know, the only real kind of, I guess, flag overall with him would be just overall part of his measurables being the weight. But I think, you know, did he come in underweight for the combine to try to run better? Because normally doesn't he weigh in around 180 or right at 179 or right around in there?
Yeah, he came in really light for the combine. He was the lightest corner at, I forget what he was, 173. I think there was a report that he was sick. Okay. Now, you know, is that agent speak? I don't know. He came in heavier for his pro day. It looks like maybe 182 for his Clemson pro day. And so never going to be exactly a 200-pound solidly built corner, always going to be on the lankier side. To me, the lack of length was the more surprising thing with Wiggins. He was, 30.5-inch arms, mm-hmm. which is poor just overall, especially given his almost 6'2 frame. But for Pittsburgh, that has been gravitating seemingly towards more of those longer press corners like Joey Porter Jr., Corey Trice, now Dante Jackson has extreme lack of length. So there is an exception there, but we're talking about, you know, the trade as opposed to a first round draft pick. But to me, I was a big fan of Wiggins, one of the first guys I watched, high level cover corner, really top end guy, good leaping, good timing ability. The tackling's inconsistent. He's got hit power. I mean, he can flash it, but he will miss too many tackles and needs to really kind of work on refining, a little similar to Porter last year, where it was not his calling card. Not that he can't do it or won't do it or won't be able to improve. And Porter got much better throughout the course of the season. But certainly you're drafting a guy like Nate Wiggins for his coverage ability, his man coverage ability, as opposed to kind of the classic old school Steelers cover 3 tackling cornerback.
He can fly too, man. Boy, you see him track down. I think was it after an interception, I think, that he got back down the field on one of those plays and ended up making a play? But, I mean, his speed is evident on tape. Ran, what, a 4.2? Officially, I think it was, according to NFL Network, a 4.28 at the combine. I think he registered the fastest 40 of the cornerback group this year here. But, look, I mean, he's – You can't discount the possibility of him being the pick at 20.
No, not based off the Blues clues. Now, is it more likely it's an offensive lineman? Yeah, I think so. But they still show an interest in cornerbacks, whether that's him, Terrion Arnold from Alabama, Kool-Aid McKinstry being at that pro day, you know, would potentially suggest some level of interest, like Taylor at that pro day to work out some of those Alabama DBs. yeah, Wiggins, the speed is real. And it wasn't, I don't believe, an interception. There were two great chase down plays. One was a long run. I forget what the other, what the maybe nature of the play was. There was a run down the right sideline, but he had two plays where he hawked down a player and forced a fumble or saved a touchdown. So the efforts there, get to really see him open up his speed. It is legit 4.28 type of speed, and it translates to the tape. So, yeah, again, just high-end cover corner to me overall. He talked about how he was kind of immature early in his Clemson career, had to grow up and I think matured and became just a better kind of quote-unquote professional, even though he was in college, but just had a better approach to the game. And so probably some appreciation for his journey of somebody that really grew up throughout his college career. So, you know, where will he go exactly? It's tough to tell in this cornerback class with him, Quinyon Mitchell, Arnold, McKinstry, DeJean from Iowa. The injury there kind of, you know, muddies the water a bit on him. He'll be working out next week, DeJean will, for kind of his private workout for Iowa. But, you know, Wiggins, I think, should be a first round corner. Just the question is that lack of weight. You know, you saw Emmanuel Forbes this past year become a first round pick, but struggle some, and he was severely kind of underweight. So we'll see how teams evaluate him. But Pittsburgh's interest there is pretty clear.
Yeah, yeah, it is. So it'd be interesting to watch the rest of the, you know, how this plays out. We've got, I don't know, what, about a little bit over half of the visitors now in?
I think we're sitting at 17 or so. So, yeah, just over half.
All right. McCaffrey, kind of a mid-round guy, obviously got the bloodline.
Sure. Yeah, the younger brother of Christian McCaffrey, and obviously what their father, Ed McCaffrey, as well. He was McCaffrey, Luke, I think, what, a quarterback and switched to wide receiver, and so kind of a bit newer to the position overall. Tested well. You know, there's just probably some refinement needed for a guy that has not played a ton of wide receiver in his career.
And then I don't know much about the offensive lineman.
He was someone I was going to start to watch last night, and then they, of course, signed Pruitt, so I will have to do that this weekend. Jones is big. He's listed 6'5", 340, primarily a guard, played, I think, right guard all 13 games this year next to Powers Johnson. He played some right tackle, too, so there's a bit of flexibility in terms of his experience, skill set, background, some tackle, guard work, but likely will be ticketed inside. I'm going to have to do work on him. Have not, you know, did not get the time to spend time on Jones last night, but is viewed as a seventh round undrafted type of guy.
Yeah, I'm going to try to watch a little bit on him maybe later on this evening.
Okay. So again, Pat Meyer at that pro day, maybe liked what he saw there. Obviously they're primarily to watch Powers Johnson, but maybe Stephen Jones. What did he test? Let me see what Stephen Jones at least tested. I don't know. That was probably spectacular, kind of given his size. We'll see if we have numbers on that. Don't believe he was combine invite. He came in at 6'5", 342, 34 5/8 inch arms, 10 3/4 hands, 189, 10 split, 23 reps on the bench with for long arms. Is not a bad number. 21 inch vertical, 7'9 broad. So the athletic testing is not great, but you're 342 pounds, late round pick, not expecting it to be fantastic. So I'm guessing probably somebody that can get after it in the run game.
All right. All right. That'll be something to look for later on this evening. I'll try to pull a couple of games.
All right, Dave, you were burning the midnight oil last night on some Duke 2020 tape. Had I told you back in January, you'd be knee deep in the, I don't know, Miami versus Duke 2020. What would you say?
Yeah, I would never imagine I'd gone down that rabbit hole, but we talked about it long enough, wondering what the tape at center look like with one Graham Barton. I put it off long enough. Curiosity was killing me. I went down that rabbit hole these last two nights to look at, and unfortunately only had TV tape to go off of both of them there. So I was kind of limited there. The two games that I pulled on him were right in order and later on in the season as well too. I tried to pick what PFF had deemed his best and his worst game at center there. And that ended up being the Georgia Tech game, which was later on in that 2020 season. And then the Miami game, which was the game after that, I think December 5th. They got smoked by Miami. Georgia Tech game was a lot more competitive going back and forth there. Here's the things that stuck out. Once again, you kind of limited there. The bad thing about the Miami game is they got down. I mean, they got jumped on quick. And now I think it was something like 21 or 24, nothing even at halftime. And it ended up being even more lopsided, 48, nothing score in there. Whenever you get down like that, you're obviously having to pass a lot, do things in the passing game. So you don't get as much run action to watch in that one. The Georgia Tech game, what I think impacted his score negatively, at least when it comes to his PFF grading there, is he had three penalties in that game. He had a false start where he kind of jerked on, you know, on the snap there and got called for it there. He had a holding call in that game, and he had an ineligible man downfield penalty in that one. Kind of all over the place as far as his snapping went, not so much low as it was high and outside and, you know, shotgun snaps and all like that. That stuck out to me. Now, his snapping looked a lot better one game later in the game against Miami. He seemed to have cleaned up his shotgun snapping quite a bit overall. As a whole, with what they were asking him to do, in his execution in both those games at center, he did not look like a fish out of water at all. You know, as far as that goes, looked like he'd played the position and understood what he was asked to do. A lot of things asked to kind of on these out quick outside, quick, you know, wide receiver screens and stuff like that, asked to release and get out into the flat. You could see the athleticism of him quite easily on that in other areas too. Anytime he was asked to release and get off the line, get to the next level, I thought he did that quite well, and the athleticism was there. One thing I did note, and I've learned to watch for this kind of thing with offensive and defensive linemen as a whole, is how much on the ground are they? Mm-hmm. And you know, that's one thing that you know, you go back to Kendrick Green, especially his time with the Steelers in the NFL, Martin was on the ground a little bit more than what I liked in specifically in this Georgia Tech game, but a little bit in the Miami game as well too. He does, and this might be related to kind of him being a bigger guy. He does seem to kind of lunge and bend forward a little bit too much, but I found him to be on the ground a little bit more than I would have liked to have seen him be. And look, when you're on the ground, you can't help your team there overall. Physicality is definitely there. I think pass protection, fairly sound overall. The sad thing, once again, is more than half of this Miami game, they were behind, so you don't get to see a lot of run action there. My takeaway from watching these two games was, okay, he can play center. I didn't come away floored thinking, oh man, what great center tape here. It merely seemed average overall based on what I perceived the play call was and what he was asked to do, those kind of things there. So, yeah, you know, I don't think he's a detriment at the position overall, but there was just nothing that jumped out, you know, from an elite aspect of, man, this guy's got NFL center. Now, once again, we're talking about 2020. He was thrust into the position. Man, they had some injuries that even led up to that having to take place. But, you know, he did not seem out of place. And the bad thing, you know, as we talked in a couple of the previous shows here, how much value is there mm-hmm. in going back all the way to 2020 to look at two games to, you know, you're at least you get the aspect that he did not look at like a fish out of water in playing the position. But my takeaway was there wasn't anything special there on that center tape either.
Sure. But that was going to be my big question. And you alluded to it. and I don't want to make this a leading question because it's open to interpretation, but as you mentioned, he's on the ground a lot. We're talking his first college starts, essentially, among them. And he's got, 39 college starts at Duke. And so what you are in start number 3 or 4 compared to start 38, 39, even at different position like left tackle, are typically completely different. So in your mind, how much stock, how much value are you really taking into this tape that you're watching on him back in 2020 as a center?
The only valuable thing I came away with was the fact that it's there, it's on tape. He's played a position. He did not look uncomfortable doing so, really.
So you view it as a positive overall because he did it and did it competently enough, even if it was years ago.
Right. That would be from a having value in 2024 now, that would be the value of seeing that. And then look, I thought once again, the snaps in the game against Georgia Tech, I started to think, okay. But he cleaned that up one game later. So I'd have to go through every snap, in 2020. I'm not doing that.
how many starts at center did he have going into that Georgia Tech game? Or was that his first career start at center?
No, because he had played 5 or 6 games, didn't he, at center?
Right. So which game was this?
And these were later in the season. So, because look, it went Georgia Tech, Miami, and then Florida State to close out the season. So that was 2 of the 3 final games that Duke played that season. So obviously he had to play earlier in the season at the position.
So this was not his first game at center. Right. Had that been his first game, you might be able to explain the inconsistent snaps a bit more, but he had some experience. Again, still a freshman, not a ton of time, but there is a difference between his first start at center versus his 4th or 5th start at center.
Sure.
Okay. Where do you come in just overall on Barton as a potential pick at 20? That's the ultimate question. From all the tape, where do you come in on him? Should he be an option? Would you be okay with that? Are you advocating for that? Are you against Barton being the pick at number 20?
The 2020 tape did not answer that question any.
Okay.
Other than just notating that he looked comfortable at the position, played the position and all like that. To me, there's still a lot of projection involved with him overall,
Mm-hmm.
I kind of wonder if a lot of NFL teams might be looking at him as a guard.
He was working out center at his pro day, though, so that would tell me the teams are viewing him as a center.
And look, they didn't put him, when you go into the Zach Frazier tape with him, you see him pull out quite a bit, right? Get moved outside the tackle and have to log block back inside. He was not asked to do that, at least in those 2 games at center at Duke. Now, does that mean he doesn't have the ability to do that? No. It's just we've seen we've seen Frazier enough to know what his ceiling and his maybe limitations are as a center. It's easy to kind of project him. It's less so still when you have a guy like Barton. Now, once again, I think the mobility's there. The athleticism is definitely there, but in no way, shape or form do I feel like, watching 2 2020 games of Barton at center, can I say that makes me feel more or less comfortable at him at 20?
What about just what you know on Barton overall as a prospect, just in totality of his resume, his pro day workout? Would you come on him, just everything, all the information that you have on him for the pick at 20?
Man, you better have a plan with him and you better be good with these projections because there's still a level of projection with him. You're really drafting the traits with him and the measurables. Sure.
In the concern, I would just say, even though I have kind of more advocated for the selection, would be okay with it, is there really is not a great veteran alternative. And that was, again, the issue with Kendrick Green. It was, you're the guy, Kendrick Green. Whether you're ready or not, you are the guy. We have no viable alternative. I mean, there was J.C. Hasenauer, who, in hindsight, maybe should have been the guy over Green, but they didn't have a veteran to really compete. There is Nate Herbig this year, but again, he's really a guard. He's not played center either. So you have a couple of guys kind of, in a sense, playing out of position, competing for the spot. So Pittsburgh has kind of, I think, done themselves a disservice by not having a veteran guy to turn to should that young rookie product not quite be ready to play center day one.
When you remember back to the tape of Kendrick Green in college at Illinois at center, well, it wasn't awful.
My thoughts on him, and it really applied to center and guard, was just, you know, constantly having the catch and the lack of length and the technique. I know that Barton is longer, but not incredibly, you know, longer. He's just under 33, and I think Green was just under 32 and a half inch arms. But I don't think, I thought Green was having to hold on a lot and trying to anchor, and bull rushes were an issue because he was smaller, he was shorter, and the lack of length all really hurt him. Barton, to me, is bigger, stronger, a little bit longer as well. And
right,
so that's
but
that's
a measurable aspect of it.
Sure,
though, you know?
Sure. But I mean, you got, in Pat Meyer's system, the center is one-on-one in pass pro more than other systems because the guards, if they're uncovered, they're usually helping the tackle. They're giving inside help to the tackle so he can really kind of protect the edges. And the center is left 1v1 more. So you need somebody that really can anchor and stall out and hop step and absorb some of those power rushes. I think Barton has a much better frame to support that. Again, Barton is 6'5", what, 313. Green was 6'01 and change, just under 6'2", maybe 305. I think their body types are much, if they stood next to each other, they wouldn't look anything alike. So I think there is a difference between, you know, the Green and the Barton, where I know that comparison will be made a lot, should say Barton become the pick at 20.
And look, if you pick Barton at 20, you're picking him to be center too, and you're picking him at least based on the roster, the way this roster is set right now, you're going to try to fast track him too, you know?
Sure. You have no choice. I mean, if you're a first round pick, you got to hold a center, you know, hope that you're the guy. But I think your point is well taken that Frazier, it's cliche to say, and these things don't always work out in practice in terms of safe and high floors, but Frazier is the high floor, lower ceiling type, I would say, compared to Barton, whereas Barton is the, you know, lower floor, more boom bust potential, but with a really high ceiling. Because if he can play center, get a really good athlete with great size there in the middle, that could be your guy for 10 years.
I think with Frazier, I think at least you have somewhat in your head an established ceiling.
And an established floor.
And a floor.
Right. Well, as much as we can do that, well, obviously,
right.
Safety in drafts is kind of a misnomer, but relative to prospects overall.
I think with Barton, all you kind of have is an idea of what the floor will be and nothing else.
Sure. If it doesn't work at center, then you're kind of wondering, what do you do? Right. And what do you do at center and what do you do with Barton become two outstanding questions.
Look, I mean, could I, other than the Blues Clues and aspect of it, you know, am I ruling him out? No, but it would make for being it would be stop the presses. They drafted a guy that Conn and Tomlin weren't at their pro day. You got a guy that, once again, you're more projection at a position and a position that you really, really need to get right this time as well too. So, that leads to the uncertainty of would they really go that direction?
What do you think is more
because
likely?
He gets off the bus and he looks it, you know?
Mm-hmm. What do you think is more likely in terms of where they go in the first round? If I just gave you two choices and did the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire 50-50, and I told you they're going to draft either a tackle or a center in round one at pick 20, which do you think is more likely they select?
Tackle.
Okay. The question becomes, and I probably am still leaning that way, even though I put Barton in my last mock draft, but I think it just depends on some different variables.
If it's going to be a center, it's going to be Johnson or Barton.
Not Frazier. You don't think Frazier's in that round one bucket?
Okay. I don't.
Assuming that's correct, and tackle is the pick in round one. How do they handle center in round two? Do you just hope the board falls to you and things break nicely as they did last year with the overall, you know, Porter falling to their laps at 32? Do you go trade up for somebody, or do you have a totally different plan?
Yeah, I mean, I think how many centers are going to go in the first round, and do you think if Barton or Frazier do slide into the second day, how far will one of the two at least fall down to you? It's just one of those things that you can't answer until you start to see how this thing starts to shake out. We've seen centers get pushed down, though, over the years. I'm almost wondering if they're betting on Frazier to fall to them.
It's a risky proposition. Right. Centers do fall. I don't disagree. But what if he falls to 50 instead of 51? You know, and yeah, he fell a little bit, quote unquote, but he was gone. And not to make this analogy too strong, but in the mock draft that we did, or that I did for Walk the Mock this past weekend, centers fell, but they didn't fall all the way. Mm. And I was left holding the bag. So if I'm Pittsburgh, just personally, I'm not saying this will happen. I think it should, and it wouldn't surprise me, kind of thing, given, I think, more aggression he's shown in the draft. But if you take a tackle in round one, I'm working the phones for day two to trade up for a center. It may cost me a fourth round pick or something, but I'm willing to do it because I think once those top three centers go, it becomes a real big unknown of what you're going to do at that position.
Yeah, and you would think, too, they like having those two-thirds, and they probably want – you know, would they really want to give up one of those thirds? But they might have to.
Maybe. I'm looking at that fourth round pick too. Khan traded a fourth round pick last year to go up three spots, which actually was pretty cheap to get Broderick Jones. Do you trade a fourth to go up 10 spots in this year's class to get a Frazier or somebody?
It's possible.
And if they do trade up, you think it would be for Zach Frazier? Because I think Barton's still going to be a first-round guy, even if it's later, and Powers Johnson might be going, you know, early second round.
All right, we've talked I just wanted to note that we had talked about that 2020 Duke tape and wondered about it, so I checked that box now for myself. So we've had some pretty good conversations about Barton now.
Yeah. Any thoughts on leaders in the clubhouse at tackle for Waga? We don't talk about the West Coast guys too much, the Washington, Oregon State guys for Waga, Fontenot, even Rosengarten, probably not in play at 20, but any thoughts there? For Waga, I mean, he's aggressive, not super big, but I mean, he's a pretty powerful and athletic guy as well.
Yeah, I really think that if you did not go the Mims route, that he could potentially be in play at 20 as a tackle.
Yeah, I mean, I know some of the projections are these guys are going to be top 10 picks, but there are so many tackles in this class, Dave. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of these guys are going to fall. And again, with the quarterbacks, the receivers, it's going to push some of these guys down. So who will fall and all that is, you know, anyone's guess right now. But you know that Joel's going to be long gone. Foshinu may be slipping a little bit, but, you know, should still likely be gone. So it'll be one tackle taken, you know, Fontenot, Fuaga, Mims, Latham. I mean, not all those guys will be gone by pick 20.
They will end up with one of those ones you just named. That's a broad, I know it's a broad list, but I mean, they're pretty predictable when it comes to the length and some of the measurables. And it's obviously a need early in this draft as well, too. So I feel comfortable saying that, you know, one of, oh, roll through the names again here.
Of the tackles?
Yeah, and ooh. I guess it'll be interesting to see where the league comes down on Fashanu out of Penn State because of that, or not him. I'm talking about Fontenot out of Washington because of the length there. Going to be interesting to see. You know, a lot of people still slam dunking him, I think, in the first round. I'm not so convinced still when it comes to him, but obviously Mims, the Oregon State.
Fuaga, although some people think he's a guard, he's shorter. He's taller, but he has less length. And we know that Pat Meyer typically likes length with his tackle. So in that respect, that'd be a break from precedent.
I mean, as deep as this class even is, though, you probably want to come out of the top two rounds with one of them.
With one of those tackles?
With the tackle. Now, I think Rose, I view Rosengarten as more of a third round type, but he could certainly be in play in the second round if you don't get one in the first round.
Yeah, in terms of second round tackles, we have not really spent much time talking or thinking about that, and the names I think are harder to come up with. Rosengarten could be one of those names. Beyond that, I mean, in terms of guys they've shown interest in, it's pretty light. It's been concentrated closer to the top of the draft, which may indicate they are going to go tackle in the first round. I mean, you look at a Patrick Paul from Houston, the Yale kid, for example, but we've not really heard much from Pittsburgh showing interest. Doesn't mean they can't draft him, but you know, their interest has been more concentrated on those first round possibilities.
True.
All right, Dave, any other final thoughts here? Any other draft thoughts, prospects you're watching, anything like that?
No, just other than going to dive deep into that guard later today that we talked about earlier.
Hey, we should mention the jersey numbers officially announced for the Steelers. Most of them, or many of them, were leaked by, I'm not sure how this guy does it, but there's a Twitter account that's able to suss out jersey numbers before anybody else. I think he goes through, like, I don't know, code or text. I don't know how he does it. But the jersey numbers for the Steelers free agents have been announced. I'll just read off the entire list here of all the new guys they have added, although not Pruitt. We don't know that. This came in before the Pruitt signing was announced. But Justin Fields will officially wear number 2. So no one gets number 1. Fields has worn that back since high school, but Pittsburgh does not hand out number 1, and so Fields will become number 2. Russell Wilson will keep number 3, Kyle Allen number 4, Cameron Johnston, the punter, number 5. Patrick Queen, as he said in his press conference, will keep his number 6 jersey, so Pittsburgh making an exception there. Van Jefferson, 11, Quez Watkins, 16, Deshaun Elliott, 25, Dante Jackson, 26, Cordell Patterson was crowdsourcing his jersey number, but he will keep his 84, and Dean Lowry at number 94, taking Armon Watts' old digits.
Do you like single-digit defensive linebackers?
It's weird, for sure, and as somebody who's been charting, I kind of prefer that old-school numbers because it's easier for me to chart and looks less weird in my spreadsheet, but I don't want to be that just much of a prude, I guess. So, yeah, I'm good with Queen keeping
it. Yeah, at its core, I'm fine. I'm just traditionalist overall, and it is weird to look at. Of course, we had to look at it a couple years ago with Melvin Ingram, when he was in the single digit as well too there. But yeah, look, I mean, it's newsworthy, but how many, you know, will all these guys make the roster? Probably not, especially some of the wide receivers.
Does Pittsburgh not hand out one because of the implication of I'm number one, I'm the best, or is it Gary Anderson jersey number being unofficially retired? Do we know why they don't have
it? I don't know if we know specifically why. Could be a mixture of those things there.
Okay, but we know that is George Pickens tried to get that last year, his rookie year, and he did not, and Fields has been denied as well.
All right, what else we got, Dave, to talk about?
I think that's all I had. If you have anything, feel free, or we can get to some reader emails and close out today's show.
Did we get through everything on the production list
In our deep 2-hour pre-production meeting that we had? I believe so. If we miss anything, we will come back and talk about it on Monday. Scott Bevell has his new mock draft up. You guys can give that a read, and again, be sure to check out the Depot Dive with Ross McCorkle and Joe Clark.
All right, let's get to some reader emails and close out the show. Let's start with Craig McKinney, cornerback in round 1. Good morning, gents. Thank you for all you guys do during this time of year. My question is, I have this terrible gut feeling the Steelers are going to take a cornerback in round 1 versus O-line or center. While, yes, we need secondary help, no question, our offensive line needs major improvement more so than cornerback, especially high-end talent. Reading the Blues Clues just gives me a sick feeling we may be leaning towards cornerback and then trying to find a center in the second round, which we saw with Alex's walk the mock. Danger, danger. What do you guys think? Peace and love, Craig. Craig, is this recency bias because of Wiggins being brought in? You know, did that generate this question? Here's what I keep going back to. Man, how many times have we heard trenches from Khan and Tomlin, I guess. It seems like we do hear it every offseason, but you know, I maybe it's my recency bias here in that it really I'm with Craig in the fact that I do wonder if you did go corner in round one or even really round two for that matter. I mean, it's more plausible. It feels like in round two, but if you did go corner in round one, and I think you had kind of an article sort of along this lines, well, you know, kind of inferring that if they messed up this draft, what would that look like? I don't know if you specifically went down that rabbit hole or not, but
if they messed up the draft at corner, what do you mean by, I'm trying to think of what,
I mean,
what
by taking a corner, because there is so many holes and corner does feel less,
okay,
less of a immediate early need than center and tackle.
Yeah, I mean, slightly.
They need a slot corner is what they need. Yeah. And Wiggins has not played inside. Dante Jackson has not played inside. I mean, there is a gaping hole there, but with the with the prospects that you would deem them taking in one of the early rounds, I don't think round one corner fits that need as a slot guy.
No, I mean, I don't think they're going to do that. I mean, you have DeJean from Iowa who can play inside out, but not much smoke on him so far. Again, the injury complicates things. But even at an outside corner, it's not an immediate need right now. But in 2025, you know, Jackson's going to be a free agent. It's looking like an immediate need for next year. So it's sure. It's a 1 year away type of need. I mean, listen, Pittsburgh has shown, I mean, the pro days they were at, they had a bunch of corners. Like Taylor was at a bunch of places this year. And yeah, Grady Brown was, to our knowledge, nowhere to be found this year. But that typically is more of a positional coaches are typically more of the round two type of guys. You know, typically in round one, you're looking for Tomlin and Kahn, and they were at pro days where you had Arnold and McKinstry and Wiggins. And of course all the smoke on him. So, I mean, just if you played off the history and the history alone, there's a lot of signals indicating cornerback.
Craig, I would tell you this, that you cannot completely rule out them taking a corner at 20, especially with the Alabama cornerback and Wiggins obviously coming in. You know, there are candidates to be that pick at 20 overall. If you did go that way, you certainly would think that round two would be the center. And the only saving grace, I think, out of all this is just what we just hit on, is that the tackle position is deep this year. And you could conceivably pick up a tackle that could compete for the starting right tackle job in camp in round three.
Potentially, although I think it's deep, but they go fast too. I mean, a lot of those talented tackles don't just hang out until, you know, pick 90 or 85 or something like that. The other issue with tackle though is Pittsburgh is really looking for a right tackle, which does limit that pool. There are right tackles out in this class, probably more than usual, but it is unless they wanted to take a left tackle and try to flip him, but you talk about some projection there and kind of shuffling things around along your offensive line, I think Pittsburgh would certainly greatly prefer somebody with right tackle experience to make that evaluation cleaner and that projection a little less, vague. So what if, you know, Latham is gone, and what if Mims goes off at 19? You know, what do you do then? And what if those corners do fall?
Yeah. I mean, what if the Toledo kid's sitting there staring you in the face too, you know,
right.
With him, you know, that's once again, I understand the concerns and I don't think you can completely sit here and rule it out, you know, of corner in round one.
Sure. There's a lot of needs for this team right now. It's the old, and I used this phrase in an article the other day.
It makes it messier though, or at least feeling a little bit messier if you go corner in the first, right?
Yeah. I mean, because then what do you do at center and tackle and D line and receiver? And you got a million questions that pop up. There's no question. But Pittsburgh has 8 pounds of needs to try to fit into a 5-pound bag of picks right now. And that's tough to do. And do you argue trading down and try to acquire more capital to try to fill some of those needs? Obviously, in terms of trades, you really don't know until you can stare at the board and you have offers in front of you. You really don't know until you're basically on the clock, but something for this team to consider.
All right. Craig writes in, I think it's a bit of an exaggeration that the Steelers draft wide receivers so well. Which wide receiver have we drafted has gone on to be a star other than AB? Most were solid, but nothing more than that. Even older picks like Mike Wallace and Santonio Holmes and even Hines Ward were fine, but not elite. Most teams draft similar level players at wide receiver at the level like Gabe Davis or Christian Kirk. People make it seem like we find a Justin Jefferson and Tyree Kill in the third rounds, and we really don't. He says, what am I missing? Look, I mean, it's fair when you look. They do better seemingly hitting the earlier in drafts with wide receivers than they do later in drafts. But, I mean, you could probably rubber stamp that around the league. Look, for what Deontay Johnson was in his time in Pittsburgh and where they got him, there's nothing wrong with that pick, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, I think Pittsburgh's track record overall has been strong. There have been some, you know, studies to kind of quantify how well teams draft certain positions. And I think Pittsburgh has still come out near the top, maybe not quite as, you know, slam dunk the best team at drafting receivers, but it's way up there. And listen, if you got to even get a Mike Wallace in the second, you know, round or, you know, that type of a player is still really good because there are some receivers who just absolutely flame out and just, you know, Denzel Mims, for example, and Pittsburgh's had some of them as well. Sammy Coates, Lima Swede, et cetera. But, you know, I wouldn't discount, not every pick for it to hit has to become AB, you know, Hall of Fame caliber. Getting a really quality impact player at receiver can also be really valuable on day two.
I mean, Martavis Bryant would have been a star in this league. I mean, even more than he, you know, obviously was in his prime had he kept his head on straight, it feels like.
Yeah, or had the NFL implemented their, you know, relaxed marijuana policy just 10 years earlier. Bryant's probably still playing in the league right now and probably still dominating.
I don't know about this long, but I mean, he was you know, there were a lot of highlights on that tape. That's for sure. And Mike Wallace was, even though he was a one trick pony, he damn sure did that trick well, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. His speed was unparalleled.
Yeah. Look, I mean, does this team miss at wide receiver? Yes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can go through Willie Reed, Lima Swede, Sammy Coates, James Washington, probably overall, you consider that a miss, you know, despite probably a little more complication, a quarterback situation, but not the player that I think, you know, we hoped that he would become at his best. So, yeah, they miss, but there's a ton of hits as well. And again, some of the studies and metrics, I think, have judged Pittsburgh favorably. And again, his arguments, you know, did Ben help make the receivers look really good? Get a Hall of Fame quarterback thrown to your receivers? Absolutely. There's no question about that. But overall, I think Pittsburgh has drafted the position well.
The second part of the question, in the beginning of the draft process, I remember Cedric Van Pran was the number one center, and now he's a third round draft prospect. How can that happen? It's not like he played games since then. The tape is the tape. If he was best in February, why would he be the fourth best now? Just wondering why this would happen. It's the draft community catching up with all the tape of all the prospects.
100%. Yeah. The way that sometimes things get viewed early on, this happens every year, even in this class, there's other prospects. I think about a Kalen King from Penn State initially, probably, you know, December viewed potential top guy. And now he probably day three type of candidate. So lack of length of Van Pran, Granger, some other guys to get more attention, guys that declare, et cetera. These things happen every year.
You got to separate the draft community from the actual NFL scouting community, you know. Now, sure, a lot of that stuff will filter through, hey, watch this guy and, you know, friends of friends or somebody that has connections, you know, that kind of stuff there. But generally what you see happen here is guys that you're talking about right after the season or even late in a regular NFL season of being potential number one at this position group, once the draft community as a whole starts going through getting deeper into more guys at various positions, that's where you see the shuffling start happening.
Yeah, but I think you said it well, Dave. There's a lag between the draft community catching up to where the NFL, right, you know, evaluates these guys, and that gets reflected in some of the initial thoughts on guys like Vampire and Granger.
And you're crowdsourcing this early on as well, too, because we don't, as much as we'd like to, we don't all sit around watching five prospects, three games each in late December,
Right.
So you take from, well, I trust what that guy said and he has him. So that becomes a narrative. And then slowly the narrative start getting busted up as more people that you trust start watching tape, that kind of thing there. So that, Craig, that's really the best explanation I can give you as to why that happens.
Yeah. Well said.
Joe writes in, Joe from York, PA. It's clear from Khan's comments that they would like to move Broderick back to left tackle. However, what if Olaf Ashanu or Joe Alt somehow are still on the board at 20? Let me tell you, if Joe Alt's on that board at 20, you don't mess around. You sprint and run that card up, in my opinion there. But I get the gist there. Yeah, I think obviously they'd like to get Broderick over to left tackle, but you don't bypass what you would probably conceive in your head as a blue chip plug and play guy at left tackle if he's on the board there for you.
Yeah, good problem to have. We'll cross that bridge in the unlikely event that we come across it overall. I think Vashinu, could slip some and maybe go into the double digits when he was viewed as a potential top five pick a year ago because of the weaker tackle class, even early on in this process. Probably, we'll come down a little bit. It's not that Broderick Jones, maybe he could become a really good right tackle. I thought he looked good there overall last year, pass protection waned late in the season. You just know it's his natural spot and knowing the mistakes and regrets you might have about Kevin Dotson, Kendrick Green, you don't want to have that what if. Yeah, he's a good right tackle, but could he become a great left tackle if we had just moved him over? And are we doing him with this disservice and stunting his development? This has happened, frankly, just too often, I think, with Pittsburgh. And probably they're not the only team that does it if you study every other team as closely as we do the Steelers. But you look at the Marvin Leal, Pittsburgh never really had a good plan for him. I think back to Sean Davis, who was moving around so much, Dave. He was strong safety, slot corner, free safety. They just could not put him in one singular spot. And I think you stunt development when you don't have really good plans and kind of push these guys around some. So, again, you cross that bridge when you come to it. I would like to move Broderick Jones over, but if you had a stud left tackle that falls, okay, maybe the discussion changes.
Right. Okay, Matthew McCarthy has a little bit longer one here. While I know it says trade down to flip my frown, he says, while I know they are not one-to-one match in terms of what will really happen, my name is Matt and I have a problem. I'm a draftaholic. I have been using a lot of different mock draft simulators that are offered these days to work through potential draft scenarios. This exercise has been increasing my anxiety levels about how the center position will be addressed. I've seen some of your posts on the site about this as well and raising my interest in potential trade down scenario. It just feels like there are too many holes to fill with the number of picks we have, and it might put us in a better position to move around the draft board to get into a plug and play center range. He says Jackson Powers Johnson has been going in an average draft position of 24.6. Graham Barton has had ADP of 31.6, and Josh Frazier has been Zach Frazier has been ADP 39.3. I don't like the idea of reaching for a center at 20, but I like the idea of missing out on But I like the idea of missing out on all three of the candidates I mentioned, even less. Out of 28 times running the simulator, Graham Barton never made it to 51. Powers Johnson made it once, and Frazier made it 46% of the time. He says, I feel it's risky. Couple this with some teams such as Buffalo, Kansas City at the later end of the round. A lot of wide receivers. Anyway, his wonder here is wonder if it might be wise, I guess, to trade down a couple of spots and probably pick something up, second or third. In other words, he does not want to miss out on one of those top three centers. And he feels like because of the draft simulators he has used, there's a possibility of that happening if they don't take one at 20.
It's a fair concern. And obviously we just discussed it, you and I, Dave, about trading down, but in terms of actually doing it, you don't know until you're on the clock. Yeah. Until you see the board. Maybe what if a great talent slips to you and you feel like you can't pass up on this guy? What if the offers just are terrible and there is interest there? You know, typically you're looking for teams that may want to come up for a quarterback or some position that has fallen. Who knows? So it all sounds good on the bumper sticker, and I'm not opposed to it. I think teams should trade down more often. I'm typically a pretty big advocate of it. More picks, more opportunities to hit and fill needs, but you just don't know until you're kind of in the moment.
Yeah, and people throughout this process always send us ideas. Well, what do you think about swapping this and that? I mean, look, you could build scenarios out every year, moving up, moving down, and us on this end, we just can't sit here and say, you know, unless it's just totally outlandish, you know. But what is outlandish these days, you know? Trying to play the guessing game as far as that goes. But on the flip side, too, if this team was to trade down in the first round, at its core, it's just hard to imagine that happening more than, say, three spots.
But why is that, though? We're not under the Kevin Colbert model. Because right. Colbert never, almost never traded down. He didn't trade down once in his last 10-plus years as GM in Pittsburgh. He only traded down in the first round once.
It just feels like you would have to want some level of assuredness that the guy that you're trading down is going to be down to where you're trading down to, of the two or three guys maybe that you have circled, you know. I'm just using that as a core.
Mm-hmm. But in return, you're only getting, you know, minimal capital. Is it really helping you to pick up a fourth round pick? Is it really filling needs?
Look, I understand the nature of this question, especially when, and look, every year we go into this thing saying, man, a lot of holes. Are there enough draft picks to fill all these holes? But, probably should be somewhat of a fear of this team potentially missing out on one of the top three centers if they don't take one at 20 and they stand put in the second round. That's the core of probably one of the greatest fears ahead of year's draft, right?
100%. 100%.
Everything else, wide receiver, slot corner, tackle, feels like it can be worked around because of the depth of the class
and the nature of Pittsburgh's offense and what they currently have. Like, if you had to go in with Dan Moore and Broderick Jones as your tackles, even if it's not ideally what anyone may want, I mean, you can live with that. I think you can make that work at center. If you lose these top three tackle or three centers, I don't know what you're doing. You're not doing something that you would prefer and feel comfortable about doing.
At least not on our end here. So, I mean, and Matthew, I don't think we can. I mean, can we soothe some of his fears here? I don't feel like we can.
Yeah, I feel like he's looking for the monster under the bed, and we're saying, yeah, he might be there. We don't know. None of us look. He might be there. So we'll have to see. Trading down makes sense. We'll see how it goes. I think center will be the most interesting question to see how this team answers it during the draft above any other position.
You know, like with anything in life and doing this show and answering emails and all that, a lot of what we receive sometimes feels like people want confirmation from us for whatever reason, you know, aspect of it. And yeah, I think at its core here, Matthew, I think it's understandable that of why you feel the way that you do. Now, can we give you the perfect answer that they are indeed going to trade down, or they aren't going to miss out on one of the top three? No. But I do think that if there was one greatest fear of the monster under the bed, it would be potentially missing out on one of these top, what we perceive to be top three centers,
or most
perceive.
And even as Mike Tomlin said, there's a couple of really good centers in this class, but then after that, you lose that plug and play option. And we don't know exactly who that's referring to. There may be different grades, and it may not be the big three, quote unquote, but we can probably reasonably assume it's the big three and maybe one other guy.
All right. We'll end up with Xerxes here, who has a bone to pick with us here. Okay. Hey, Dave and Alex, I typically agree with you today, but let's talk disagreements. I hope you like beefs. You both itching to trade for Brandon Ayuk, but his salary would be so high, wouldn't that force George Pickens out the door? Would the Steelers ever pay star money to two wide receivers, or do you see Aiyuk as Pickens' insurance? Number two, why make Broderick Jones' position contingent about how good a drafted tackle will be? Jones needs to start at left tackle because Moore isn't good enough. Steelers didn't trade up for Jones in the first round to be a right tackle, so they shouldn't misuse another talent because another position is undecided. I say draft a guy in the later rounds or try Moore at right tackle. What say you? All right, let's start backwards here. The team has already told us they don't like Moore at right tackle.
And Moore has already told us that, they don't see that as a viable plan.
All right, moving backwards from there, I do think that you should be kind of looking for a guy that's got the college tape that's played right tackle, because I agree, you do need to try to get Broderick Jones over to left tackle as soon as possible this season. And it feels like that will happen in some way, shape, or form. The timing might not be perfect week one within that. So I'm wondering where the disagreement here is. Now, look, as we said, if a guy like Joe Alt falls in your lap at 20, hey, you'd probably have to ask, why the hell is he dropped down to 20 there? But I think you run that card up, and I think it would be a very unique situation if you ended up drafting a first round left tackle. That slam dunk, we've got to put this guy at left tackle, and Broderick Jones is going to have to play right side there. Is that what you're taking this? He says, why make Broderick Jones' position contingent about how good a drafted tackle will be? He says Jones needs to start left tackle. His assumption is you got to do whatever you got to do to get Jones over to the left side there.
I get that. And again, I've had the point that you want to do right by Jones, and that's going to be top priority. But you understand there has to be a plan. You can't just, put Jones over there and not think about how we're going to address the right tackle position. There has to be some, laid out thought to it that's just responsible as a organization.
All right. So I'm not seeing where a lot of the pushback is there. Now, the first part here, you're both itching to trade Brandon Aiyuk. Trade for Brandon Aiyuk, but his salary would be so high. Let's take the first part of this. Over the years, I have been associated with that guy in the Sesame Street skit with the two kind of, I don't even know what you call those characters there, where they go, nope, those characters. And I usually back those up with good reason. I try to look at the plausibility, a lot of it, but 97 times out of 100, I'm probably going to tell most people from a salary, business, all aspects of something that no, the team's probably not going to trade for this guy, that guy, that guy. That's really what, how people have associated my analysis, it seems like, over the years when it comes to that kind of stuff there. Now, the plausibility aspect from the salary cap, from the need, from the player, from all things evolved, at least presented my final conclusion of being, this is something that could plausibly happen. We mentioned several times about the contract being the issue and how out of norm that would be. Even at $20 million a year, all right, on an average yearly value for a contract for Brandon Aiyuk, even at that low, and that would probably be a bargain, he would be the number two highest earning player on your team, which would be stop the presses when it comes to what the Pittsburgh Steelers have done. If his number is $30 million, the way some people theorize it might be, it's going to be greater than TJ Watt. And you want to talk about really shutting the press down in that aspect. And we have made it clear that that's one of the biggest aspects along with the actual, what the compensation would be of the two biggest barriers when it comes to Aiyuk. Would Brandon Aiyuk fit with the Steelers and fit nicely at its core? Whatever, however that came about, would that, how would that look?
Yeah, it would fit well. He's versatile. He's a blocker. He's got some size. He's young. Yeah, I mean, it fits.
All right. Do you consider us both itching to trade for Brandon Ayuk?
I mean, that might be a touch strong, but I understand his point. We were both advocating and entertaining, and I think, you know, if it happened, we'd both be happy about that. So I'm not going to get too semantic, I think, on his commentary there.
All right. And the second part, would that force George Pickens out the door? I want George Pickens to decide whether or not it forces him out the door.
That's true.
I think, and look, I think George Pickens is a hell of a damn talent. I mean, this guy has some traits that are phenomenal that can make him perceivably top five guy in the NFL, wide receiver in the NFL. But, you know, there is the attitude and the immaturity and some of the things that go along with that that do kind of make you wonder if still, if he's going to, regardless of Ayuk comes in or not, there are some, it does make you wonder if he's guaranteed, regardless, if he's going to see a second contract.
Yeah, it's fair. I think it's the crux of the question is if you traded for Ayuk hypothetically, you know, could you feasibly financially be able to keep Pickens if you wanted to? I bet there's a path. As you always say, you know, if there's a will, there's a way.
There's always a way to keep star players depending on how bad you want to keep them.
Yeah, in a rising cap. Now, would that be, you know, unconventional compared to what Pittsburgh has been doing? Sure, but if they traded for Ayuk, that in itself would, of course, be unconventional. So we're kind of throwing all that convention out the window.
And look, if you went out, you paid a guy like Brandon Ayuk anywhere from $25 to $30 million per year, and you got in a situation where George Pickens deserves, needs, wants, you want, everything you absolutely got to get him back up underneath, you know, extended, then that number is probably going to top Ayuk's.
Oh yeah. Oh, 100%.
You know, so, you know, would I think it goes back to what I said at the start of this there, even if, and it's a huge, huge, huge ifs, very much so, if you went out and traded for a Brandon Ayuk, I want George Pickens to decide if George Pickens gets a second contract in Pittsburgh. I know that's a weird way of saying it, but I think it's true.
No, it's point taken. And you do, I mean, he's under his rookie contract through 2025, right? So, I mean, he's under team control and he can't even do an extension this offseason, right? He's not allowed to by the CBA. So,
right, it's next offseason with him. Yeah,
you would have this whole, you know, season to kind of see how it looks and benefit from Ayuk being part of your team with Pickens on a rookie contract.
And look, if George Pickens goes out in 2000, it'll be a great problem to have. Mm-hmm. If George Pickens goes out and catches anything more than 80 balls for more than 1,000 yards and 6, 7, 8, 9, 12 touchdowns, he's going to want a new contract next offseason.
Sure. But as you said, good problem to have. I would love for that to be the case. Too much talent, too much production. The passing game looks amazing. They can support apparently two outstanding receivers. I'll take it.
And now I don't view us, either one of us, I'm going to push back on him. I don't view either one of us as sitting here itching to trade for Brandon Ayuk. But if there was one guy right now that you were going to trade for that I think would be what we talked as a needle mover, that would be the guy.
But we're both in favor of the idea. I think that's the conclusion we had when we discussed it.
Right. I'm not punching holes in a wall over here. You know, thinking, sure, oh, they got a trade for Brandon Ayuk. But I part of my analysis is it plausible? And at the outset, you know, I tried to keep an open mind, look at all angles of it, and I viewed it as doable, at least on the Steelers' part. And I think he's a great player too.
Yeah. No, I agree. But you know, obviously, those things have quieted down some. We'll see. But if it comes back up, if there's more smoke, we'll talk about it.
All right. I think we've hit everything, hit quite a few reader emails here.
Also, AB wants to play for the Steelers again. He's tweeting wildly today. He says he will play for free if they give him number 86. So that is, I'm sure, we talked about in some respect today.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to bet that that does not happen. I'm going to go out on a limb there. Okay, we will be back on Monday, barring something substantial happening. And in the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter /X at Steelers Depot. Follow Alex at Alex_Kozora. Follow the show at Terrible Podcast. Email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. If you like what we do and want to donate, SteelersDepot.com. Hit the donate button. Also, if you like an ad-free version of the site, hit SteelersDepot.com. Hit the ad-free button and follow the directions that way. Good show today. A lot of stuff coming on the site this afternoon and through the weekend. Hope to keep everybody entertained. We appreciate everybody listening, reading, everything involved with supporting the site. It means a lot to us. So until Monday, potentially, as always, thanks for listening to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Alex.